Hello and welcome to Arizona Daily Sun, the National Edition. I'm Gary, who will be reading from the Arizona Daily Sun, dated Wednesday, April the 24th. We'll start with front page articles. Tabloid publisher testifies he aided Trump's candidacy. The first witness in Donald Trump's criminal hush money trial, former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker, testified Tuesday that he used his supermarket tabloid to suppress stories that might have hindered Trump's 2016 presidential bid. Pecker, 72, testified in a New York court that the Enquirer paid two people who were peddling stories of Trump's sexual misbehavior but never published them, a practice known as catch and kill. When somebody's running for public office like this, it's very common for these women to call up a magazine like the National Enquirer to try to sell their stories, Pecker testified. Pecker said the decision to bury the stories followed a 2015 meeting at which he told Trump that the Enquirer would publish favorable stories about the billionaire candidate and keep an eye out for people selling stories that might hurt him. He said he told an editor to keep the arrangement secret. Pecker said the Enquirer paid former Playboy model Karen McDougal for her story of a sexual relationship with Trump in 2006 and 2007. He said he bought the story after Trump refused to do so himself. He said that anytime you do anything like this, it always gets out, Pecker said. The Enquirer's parent company, American Media, said in 2018 it paid $150,000 for the story. Trump has denied having an affair with McDougal. The tabloid also paid $30,000 for a story peddled by Trump Tower doorman Dino Sachuin, who claimed Trump fathered a child with a maid who worked for him. The story turned out not to be true. Both payments far exceeded the amounts the paper typically paid for stories, he said. I made the decision to buy the story because of the potential embarrassment it would have made to the campaign and Mr. Trump, Pecker said. He is expected to testify further when the trial resumes on Thursday. Prosecutors say Pecker's actions helped Trump deceive voters in the 2016 election by burying stories of alleged extramarital affairs at a time when he already faced multiple accusations of sexual misbehavior. They have charged Trump with criminal falsifying business records to cover up a $130,000 payment to buy the silence of porn star Stormy Daniels, who says they had a sexual encounter 10 years earlier. Trump has pleaded not guilty and denies having an encounter with Daniels. His lawyer argued that Trump did not commit any crimes and only acted to protect his reputation. The case may be only one of Trump's four criminal prosecutions to go to trial before the Republicans' November 5th election rematch with Democratic President Joe Biden. A guilty verdict would not bar Trump from taking office, but could hurt his candidacy. Pecker's testimony came after a hearing to consider prosecutors' request to fine Trump $10,000 for violating a gag order prohibiting him from criticizing witnesses, court officials, and their relatives. Justice Juan Merchant said he would not immediately rule on the request, but he appeared unmoved by Trump's defense lawyer, Todd Blanche's, argument that Trump was responding to political attacks, not intimidating witnesses. You presented nothing, Merchant said. I've asked you 8 or 9 times. Show me the exact post he was responding to. You've not even been able to do that once. I have to tell you right now, you're losing all credibility with the court, the judge added. After the session, Trump repeated his claim that the gag order violated his constitutional free speech rights. This is a kangaroo court, and the judge should recuse himself, Trump wrote on his Truth Squad platform. New York prosecutor Christopher Conroy said Trump has run afoul of the order, pointing to an April 10 Truth Social post that called Daniels and Trump former lawyer Michael Cohen sleazebags. Both are expected to testify in the first criminal trial of a former U.S. president. Conroy said other posts led to media coverage that prompted a juror last week to withdraw over privacy concerns. He knows he's not allowed to do, and he does it anyway, Conroy said of Trump. His disobedience of the order is willful. It's intentional. The $10,000 fine sought by Conroy would be a relatively small penalty for Trump, who has posted $266.6 million in bonds as he appeals civil judgments in two other cases. Conroy said he was not at this point asking Merchant to send Trump to jail for up to 30 days, as New York law allows. The defendant seems to be angling for that, Conroy said. Blanchett said Trump's posts were responses to political attacks by Cohen and not related to his former lawyer's expected testimony. He's allowed to respond to political attacks, Blanche said. Moving to our next front page article, U.S.-Russia set for a showdown at UN over nuclear weapons in space. United States and Russia are set to face off over nuclear weapons in space on Wednesday at the United Nations Security Council, which is due to vote on a U.S.-drafted resolution calling on countries to prevent an arms race in outer space. Russia is expected to block the draft resolution, said some diplomats. The U.S. move comes after it accused Moscow of developing an anti-satellite nuclear weapon to put in space, an allegation that Russia's defense minister has flatly denied. U.S. Ambassador to the UN Lynn Thomas Greenfield and Japan's UN Ambassador Yamakase Kasuyuki said in a joint statement on Friday that they have been negotiating with Security Council members on the draft text for 6 weeks. The text affirms the obligation of states to comply with the Outer Space Treaty and calls on countries to contribute actively to the objective of the peaceful use of outer space and of the prevention of an arms race in outer space. The 1967 Outer Space Treaty bars signatories, including Russia and the United States, from placing in orbit around the Earth any objects carrying nuclear weapons or any other kinds of weapons of mass destruction. Russia and China are planning to first put an amendment to a vote in the Council. The amendment echoes a 2008 proposal by the pair for a treaty banning any weapons in outer space and threats or use of force against outer space objects. The amendment is not expected to be adopted, said diplomats. The amendment and the draft resolution each require at least 9 votes in favor and no vetoes by Russia, China, the United States, Britain, or France to be adopted. Without our amendment, based on the General Assembly resolution adopted in December 2023, the text was tabled by the U.S. will be unbalanced, harmful, and politicized, Deputy Russian UN Ambassador Dmitry Polensky told Reuters, adding it would also undermine the Outer Space Treaty legal regime. Polensky said all questions relating to this sphere should be considered by the full membership of states parties to the treaty and not by the UN Security Council members only. U.S. intelligence officials, according to 3 people familiar with their findings, believe Russia's capability to put a space-based nuclear bomb whose electromagnetic radiation, if detonated, would disable vast networks of satellites. White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby has said Russia has not deployed such a weapon. In February, Russia's President Vladimir Putin said his nation is against the deployment of nuclear weapons in space. Government increasingly have considered satellites in Earth's orbit as critical assets that enable an array of military capabilities on Earth. With space-based communications and satellite-connected drones in the war in Ukraine serving as recent examples of the outsized role of space in modern warfare. Our next front page article, the FTC approves non-compete ban. U.S. Federal Trade Commission on Tuesday approved a rule to ban agreements commonly signed by workers not to join their employer's rivals or launch competing businesses, which it says limits worker mobility and suppresses wages. The five-member FTC, which enforces antitrust laws and currently has a Democratic majority under President Joe Biden, voted 3-2 to approve the rule during a public meeting. The rule, which was first proposed in January of 2023, will take effect in August. Democrats, the commission, and worker advocates who support the rule say it is necessary to rein in the increasingly common practice of requiring workers to sign so-called non-compete agreements, even in lower-paying service industries such as fast food and retail. The FTC on Tuesday said the banning non-competes will increase worker earnings by up to $488 billion over the next decade and will lead to the creation of more than 8,500 new businesses each year. Lena Khan, who chairs FTC, said during the meeting, non-competes not only restrict workers' opportunities, but can infringe on other fundamental rights by blocking them from changing jobs. Robbing people of their economic liberty also robs them of all sorts of other freedoms, chilling speech, infringing on their religious practice, and impeding people's right to organize, Khan said. But the agency's two Republican commissioners, Melissa Holyoke and Andrew Ferguson, said federal law does not allow the commission to adopt broad rules prohibiting conduct that it deems anti-competitive. We are not a legislature, Ferguson said. I do not believe we have the power to nullify tens of millions of existing contracts. Major business groups representing an array of industries have criticized the rule, saying non-competes are a critical way of companies to protect trade secrets and that they promote competitiveness. Shortly after the vote, tax services firm Ryan LLC filed a lawsuit in Texas federal court challenging the non-compete ban and claiming that the agreements can benefit businesses, workers, and the economy. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the country's largest business lobby, said in a statement that it will also file a legal challenge to the rule. This decision sets a dangerous precedent for government micromanaging of business and can harm employers, workers, and our economy, said Susanna Clark, the chamber's president and CEO. The rule would require companies with existing non-compete agreements to scrap them and to inform current and past employees that they will not be enforced. Daryl Josepher, chief counsel at the Chamber's litigation arm, said during Monday's call that the rule's retroactive nature also makes it invalid. Unions have backed FTC's vote in favor of the ban. Non-compete agreements trap workers from finding better jobs, drive down wages, and stifle competition. The AFL-CIO, the country's largest labor federation, said in a tweet responding to the announcement, "We commend the FTC and Lena Khan for finalizing a strong rule to ban these exploited practices and level the playing field for American workers," it added. Left-leaning advocacy groups also praised the change, calling it a major victory for workers that will bolster the national economy by spurring entrepreneurship. The FTC has abolished a modern form of involuntary servitude, said Sandeep Manishan, legal director of the Open Markets Institute, a think tank that focuses on antitrust issues. Big business lobbyists are already vowing to sue the FTC to stop the non-competitive ban from going into effect. Bharat Ramamaturi, the former deputy director of the Biden White House's National Economic Council, wrote on Twitter responding to the lawsuits. They love non-competes as a way to keep workers under their thumb and suppress wages. The rule does not exempt any specific jobs or industries, but will not apply to existing agreements signed by senior executives. FTC does not regulate certain industries, including nonprofit organizations, some banks, and insurance companies and airlines. California, Minnesota, North Dakota, and Oklahoma have banned non-compete agreements, and at least a dozen other states have passed laws limiting their use. In December, New York Governor Kathy Hochul vetoed a bill that would have banned virtually all non-compete provisions in the state. Hochul said she would consider signing a bill that exempts higher-earning employees and executives. Our next front page article, the U.S. urges Iraq to safeguard troops after attacks. The U.S. military on Tuesday urged Iraq's government to take steps to safeguard American troops in both Iraq and Syria after failed attacks a day earlier by Iran-aligned militia. The drone and rockets fired were first such incidences since the nearly three-month pause in what had been almost daily attacks that culminated in the January killing of three U.S. soldiers at the Tower 22 outpost in Jordan. With U.S.-Iran tensions soaring after the Jordan attack and some calls for Republican lawmakers in Washington for a direct U.S. response against Iran, a senior Iran commander had called on militia to halt their attacks at the end of January. Speaking at the Pentagon, Air Force Major General Patrick Ryder, a spokesperson, did not speculate about what triggered the renewal in attacks, but he called on Baghdad to act. These acts put coalition and Iraqi personnel at risk. We call on the government of Iraq to take all necessary steps to ensure the safety of U.S. forces in Iraq and Syria against attacks from these groups, Ryder told a news briefing. If these attacks continue, we will not hesitate to defend our forces as we have done in the past. The U.S. has some 2,500 troops in Iraq and 900 in eastern Syria on an advise and assist mission. The United States helped Israel shoot down a massive wave of Iranian drone and missiles on April 14th, fired by Tehran in retaliation for an April 1 Israeli strike against an Iranian diplomatic facility in Syria. Washington has blamed Iran in the past for funding and directing militia in Iraq and Syria that attack U.S. forces. Iraq Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani, wary of his country becoming a battleground for fighting between the United States and Iran, met President Joe Biden earlier this month in an effort to turn a new page in U.S.-Iraqi relations despite soaring regional tensions. The U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003 and toppled leader Saddam Hussein, withdrawing in 2011 before returning in 2014 at the head of an international military coalition at the Baghdad government's request to help fight Islamic State insurgents. Moving to our next article, senators hope TikTok will remain in business in U.S. under a new owner. Washington. Two U.S. senators said they hope TikTok will remain in business in the U.S. under a new owner, as the chamber prepared to vote on Tuesday on legislation requiring China owner ByteDance to divest the popular short video app's U.S. assets. Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Mark Warner said lawmakers recognize that the short video app is used by 170 million Americans, especially young people. To those young Americans, I want to say we hear your concern, and we hope that TikTok will continue under new ownership, American or otherwise, from Britain, Canada, Brazil, France. It just needs to be no longer controlled by an adversary, driven by concerns that China could access U.S. citizens' data or surveil them with the app. The U.S. House of Representatives passed bipartisan legislation on April the 20th that would give ByteDance 9 months to divest TikTok with a possible three-month extension. If the legislation is approved by the Senate, President Joe Biden has said he would sign it into law. The company has said it would challenge the order in court. TikTok, which says it has not shared and would not share U.S. user data with the Chinese government, has argued the law amounts to a ban that would violate the U.S. free speech rights of its users. Senate Commerce Committee Chair Maria Cantwell said Congress is not acting to punish ByteDance or TikTok, but to prevent foreign adversaries from conducting espionage, surveillance, malign operations, harming vulnerable Americans. She said the timeline was reasonable. This is not a new concept to require Chinese divestment from U.S. companies, Cartwell said. We are giving people a choice here to improve this platform. But Senate Ed Markey said ByteDance was unlikely to be able to execute a divestment that maintains the app for U.S. users. We should be very clear about the likely outcome of this law. It's really just a TikTok ban, he said. Censorship is not who we are as a people. We should not downplay or deny this trade-off. Our next article. Biden rule grants overtime pay to 4 million U.S. workers. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden on Tuesday unveiled a rule extending mandatory overtime pay to an estimated 4 million salaried workers, going even further than an Obama-era rule that was struck down in court. U.S. Department of Labor rule will require employers to pay overtime premiums to workers who earn a salary of less than $1,128 per week, or about $158,600 per year, when they work more than 40 hours a week. The current salary threshold of about $35,500 per year was set by the Trump administration in a 2020 rule. The rule does not affect overtime requirements for workers who are paid hourly. Julie Hsu, the acting Secretary of Labor and Biden's nominee to fill the post permanently, said in a statement that the rule ensures that workers either earn more money or are paid the same to work fewer hours. Too often, lower paid salary workers are doing the same job as their hourly counterparts, but are spending more time away from their families for no additional pay, Sue said. Under the rule, the salary threshold will increase to $43,888 on July 1 and to $58,656 on January 1, 2025. And starting in 2027, the threshold will automatically increase every 3 years to reflect changes in average earnings. U.S. wage law requires employers to pay eligible workers 1.5 times the regular rate of pay when they work more than 40 hours in a week. Salaried workers who earn above the salary threshold may still be eligible for overtime pay if they do not primarily perform management-related duties. Workers are generally automatically exempt if they earn a salary of more than $107,432. This new rule will raise that cutoff to about $151,000. Several states, including California and New York, have salary thresholds for determining overtime eligibility that are higher than the current federal standard. In 2016, U.S. Department of Labor doubled the salary threshold to about $47,000. In 2017, a federal judge in Texas rejected it, saying the ceiling was so high it could encompass some management workers who are exempt from overtime pay protection. The new rule is likely to face legal challenges, arguing that, like the Obama administration rule, it violates federal wage law by including many lower paid supervisors and professionals who typically would not be eligible for overtime. Many major business groups have called on the department to put off any changes to overtime pay regulations, citing economic uncertainty and worker shortages that have raised companies' operating costs. This rule comes as many entrepreneurs continue to struggle in today's unpredictable regulatory climate, grappling with lingering inflation, labor challenges, and high cost of goods. Michael Lehman, Senior Vice President of the International Franchise Association, said in a statement, "The rule could harm workers by pushing many businesses to convert salary jobs into hourly positions, lowering employees' pay, and removing some benefits," according to Representative Virginia Fox, a Republican from North Carolina and chair of a U.S. House of Representatives Labor Committee. If the administration's goal with this rule is to improve the standard of living for workers, then it's failing miserably, Fox said. Unions and worker advocacy groups have supported the rule. Moving now to articles dealing with the American West. Texas inmates cooked to death in extreme heat, complaint alleges. April signals the beginning of blistering heat for much of Texas. And while the summer heat is uncomfortable for many, it can be deadly for the people incarcerated in Texas' prison system, where temperatures rarely reach triple digits. Prison rights advocates on Monday filed a complaint against Texas Department of Criminal Justice Executive Director Brian Collier, arguing the lack of air conditioning in the majority of Texas prisons amounts to cruel and unusual punishment. The filing came from four nonprofit organizations who are joining a lawsuit originally filed last August by Bernie Tedi, an inmate who suffered a medical crisis after being housed in a Huntsville cell that reached temperatures exceeding 110 degrees. Tedi, a well-known offender whose 1996 murder of a wealthy widow inspired the film Bernie, was moved to an air-conditioned cell following a court order, but he's not guaranteed to stay there this year. Monday's filing expands the plaintiffs to include every inmate incarcerated in uncooled Texas prisons, which have led to the deaths of dozens of Texas inmates and cost the state millions of dollars as it fights wrongful death and civil rights lawsuits. The plaintiffs ask that an Austin federal judge declare the state's prison policy unconstitutional and require that prisons be kept under 85 degrees Fahrenheit. Texas jails are already required to keep facilities cooler than 85 degrees, and federal prisoners in Texas have a 76-degree maximum. June to August 2023, the average temperature was 85.3 degrees, the second hottest in record behind 2011. The most recent winter season ranked warmest on record for the contiguous U.S., according to National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Scientists have found that climate change has resulted in more severe and longer-lasting heat waves. In the last decade, Texas experienced over 1,000 days of record-breaking heat compared to a normal decade. In the hottest months, those concrete and metal cells can reach over 130 degrees, formerly incarcerated Texans said during a Monday press conference. Legal representatives hope to prove those conditions are unconstitutional. What is truly infuriating is the failure to acknowledge that everyone in the system, all 130,000 prisoners, are at direct risk of being impacted by something that has a simple solution that has been around since the 1930s, and that is air conditioning, attorney Jeff Edwards told reporters. Edwards was the lead attorney in the 2014 prison rights case that cited the nearly two dozen Texas prison inmates who died from heat stroke over the previous two decades. That case culminated in a settlement where TDCJ agreed to install air conditioning at the Wallace Pack unit near College Station. About two-thirds of the inmates housed across TDCJ's facilities live in areas without air conditioning. Advocates and inmates' families have long fought to cool prisons in a state where summer temperatures routinely exceed triple digits and pose dangerous conditions to inmates and correctional officers. Although the state has not reported a heat-related death since 2012, researchers and inmates' families dispute those statistics. A 2022 study found that 14 prison deaths per year were associated with heat. In 2023, a Texas Tribune analysis found that at least 41 people had died in uncooled prisons during the state's record-breaking heat wave. Health problems that have been linked to excessive heat include renal disease, cardiovascular mortality, respiratory illness, and suicides. Julie Sakara, an epidemiologist researcher at Brown University, who authored the 2022 study, told reporters on Monday. Sakara said, while death certificates may not list heat strokes, a condition where the body can no longer control its temperature, is the official cause of death. Her research indicated that many prisoners have died from heat-related causes. Heat deaths haven't magically stopped, the lawsuit states. TDCJ has simply stopped reporting or admitting them after the multiple wrongful death lawsuits and national news coverage. TDCJ spokesperson Amanda Hernandez declined to comment on the lawsuit, saying the agency does not comment on pending litigation. But she emphasized that the department has been adding more air conditioning units since 2018. Each year, we've been working to add cool beds and will continue to do so, she said. She also pointed to the department's enhanced heating protocols, which are activated from April to October and include providing ice water to inmates and allowing them to purchase fans and cooling towels from the commissary. Lawyers argue the mitigation tactics are insufficient to combat the state's sweltering temperatures. To survive the heat, incarcerated people report having to flood their toilets or sinks and lie down in the water on the cell floor to try to cool their bodies, the lawsuit says. This isn't an unpredictable event, said attorney Eric Gossman, who is one of the lawyers representing the plaintiffs. It gets hot every summer. And much like every other building in Texas, including buildings that have animals, we cool the building. TDCJ staff who work in the facilities are similarly affected by the heat, said Michael Dietich, a senior lecturer at the University of Texas at Austin School of Law and LBJ School. The excessive heat invades all aspects of life in prison. Staff must do physical work and heavy uniforms in the heat. The situation results in more violence among those incarcerated and leads to more use of force against prisoners, she said. TDCJ states on its heat mitigation protocol that staff members share encouraged to increase their water intake during the hot summer month and are allowed to wear cooling towels and dry fit compression shirts. Prison rights advocates say the state easily could fund air conditioning units across its prison, but it has simply been unwilling to do so. During the most recent legislative session, the House proposed spending $545 million to install air conditioning in most of the prison facilities lacking it. But the final budget did not include any money dedicated to air conditioning. Our next article, environmentalists prepare to defend BLM rule against legal challenge. A new U.S. Department of Interior Public Lands rule creates measures to support conservation, recreation, and clean energy development on public lands. The rule could affect about 17% of New Mexico's land, which is overseen by the Bureau of Land Management. But even as the rule supporters celebrate, they are gearing up to defend it in court. Advocates for the conservation, recreation, and wildlife told reporters Monday that they were celebrating the rule, which changes the way land can be used on nearly 250 million acres nationwide. BLM already leases land for use like oil and gas extraction and grazing. The new rule, among other things, creates leases for restoration and mitigation and designates some areas as being of critical environmental concern. A restoration lease could enable a conservation group to restore wildlife habitat. A mitigation lease could, for instance, allow a company or organization that gets a permit for a renewable energy project to compensate for loss of habitat by restoring or enhancing habitat in a different area on public lands. It is a groundbreaking step toward leveling the playing field for conservation and tribal voices alongside other public land users, said Keegan King from the Pueblo of Acoma, the founder of the Native Land Institute and advocacy group. This is crucial for maintaining ecology system health in the face of climate change, he added, especially for rural and tribal communities reliant on traditional practices like farming, grazing, and cultural site protection. But some industry groups and politicians argue that the new policy violates the original mandate of BLM to manage lands for multiple uses by prioritizing conservation. Some have threatened legal action, including the Western Energy Alliance, whose president Kathleen Sakma said in a statement that the new rule is a classic example of overreach by the Biden administration. The added layers of red tape and federal bureaucracy embedded in the BLM's public lands rule create new roadblocks to conservation work. The health of Utah's lands and wildlife will suffer as a result, said Utah's Governor Spencer Cox, in a statement adding that the state would challenge the rule in federal court. There are very likely to be legal challenges, possibly soon, said Chris Winter at University of Colorado Law School. He thinks the challengers will have an uphill battle in court. The statute that Congress gave the BLM in 1976 says managing for the long-term sustainability of the environment, for wildlife habitat, for clean water, for recreation, for cultural values, he said. However, he said federal environmental litigation is uncertain and said BLM and U.S. Department of Justice likely will have to defend the rules vigorously in the federal court system. Now moving to some international news. UN rights chief horrified by reports of mass grave at Gaza hospitals. UN rights chief Volker Türk on Tuesday said he is horrified by destruction of the Nasser and al-Sharif medical facilities in Gaza and reports of mass graves containing hundreds of bodies there, according to a spokesperson. Palestinian authorities reported finding hundreds of bodies in mass graves at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis this week after it was abandoned by Israeli troops. Bodies were also reported at the al-Sharif site following an Israeli special forces operation. The Israeli military said claims by Palestinian authorities that the Israeli Defense Forces had buried bodies were baseless and unfounded, and it said forces searching for Israeli hostages had examined bodies previously buried by Palestinians near Nasser Hospital and had returned the bodies to where they were buried after they were examined. The process was conducted in a careful manner, said, and exclusively in places where intelligence indicated the possible presence of hostages, the military said. The examination was carried out respectfully while maintaining the dignity of the deceased. Ravin Shamdasani, spokesperson for the UN High Commission for Human Rights, said the rights organization was raising the alarm because multiple bodies had been discovered. Turk said he had been horrified by the reported mass grave discoveries and the hospital's destruction. Some of them had their hands tied, which of course indicates serious violations of international human rights law and international humanitarian law, and those need to be subjected to further investigation, Shamdasani said. She added that the UN Human Rights Office was working on corroborating Palestinian officials' reports, including 1 to 30 bodies were found at Al-Sharafa. According to those reports, some of the bodies were buried beneath piles of waste and included women and older people. Reuters reports on Monday saw emergency workers digging corpses out of the ground in the ruins of Nasser Hospital. Gaza's Hamas-run civil emergency service said on Tuesday a total of 310 bodies had been found at one mass grave at Nasser so far, and that two other graves had been identified but not yet excavated. The Palestinian Health Ministry repeated the figure. Turk, who was represented by Shamdasani at the UN press briefing, also decried Israeli strikes on Gaza in recent days, which he said had killed mostly women and children. He also repeated a warning against a full-scale incursion on Rafah, where some 1.2 million civilians are crowded together, saying this could lead to further atrocity crimes. The violence has also surged in the occupied West Bank since Israel's war on Hamas began October 7th, sparked by the latter's cross-border attacks on Israel, which killed 1,200 people, according to Israeli tallies. Palestinian health authorities said 14 Palestinians had been killed on Saturday in the Nur Shams area, in one of the heaviest tolls in the West Bank in months. Shamdasani said the UN Human Rights Office had received reports that some victims in Nur Shams had been killed in apparent extrajudicial executions. The Hamas media office has accused Israel of executions, but has not shared visual or other evidence. Israel denies carrying out executions. Israel's military previously said a number of militants were killed or arrested in the West Bank raid, and at least 4 soldiers were wounded. Going to the next article, U.S. considers sanctions against China banks that aid Russian war effort. The United States has discussed sanctions on some China banks, but does not yet have a plan to implement such measures, a U.S. official told Reuters on Tuesday, as Washington seeks ways to curb Beijing's support for Russia. The official, speaking on conditions of anonymity, said there was no plan to roll out sanctions on China's banks in the near term, and said officials hope that diplomacy will avert the need for such an action. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is due to visit China this week. The Wall Street Journal reported earlier on Monday, citing people familiar with the matter, that the U.S. was drafting sanctions against some Chinese banks in the hopes of stopping Beijing's commercial support of Russia's military production. The White House and Treasury Department did not immediately respond to requests for comment. In recent weeks, U.S. officials have intensified the pressure on China, warning that Washington was ready to take action against Chinese financial institutions, facilitating trade in goods with dual civilian and military applications. Blinken on Friday criticized Chinese support for Russia's defense industry, saying Beijing was the key contributor to Moscow's war in Ukraine through its provision of critical components for weaponry. Cutting banks off from access to the dollar, used in much of global trade, is often reserved as a last resort, as such sanctions often force banks into failure. It would also represent a particular risk for China amid a sputtering economic recovery and growing debt. The Wall Street Journal report did not describe which types of banks might be targeted, a key distinction for how large an impact any such measure would have on China's economy or its ability to support Russia economically. The U.S. has sanctioned smaller Chinese banks in the past, such as the Bank of Kunlun, over various issues, including working with Iranian institutions. But Washington has so far been reluctant to implement sanctions on major Chinese banks, long DEPA analysts as a nuclear option because of the huge ripple effects it could have on the global economy and U.S.-China relations. A spokesman for China's foreign ministry on Tuesday said China was firmly opposed to the U.S. making groundless accusations about normal trade exchanges with Russia. "We are firmly opposed to the hypocritical practice of the U.S. side itself, pouring fuel but blaming the Chinese side," Wang Wenbin said at a regular news briefing when questioned on the possible sanctions. China's right to conduct normal economic and trade exchanges with other countries, including Russia, is inviolable, said Wang. The People's Bank of China and the National Financial Regulatory Administration, China's top banking regulator, did not immediately respond to Reuters' request for comments. China and Russia have fostered more trade in yuan set instead of the dollar in the wake of the Ukraine war, potentially shielding their economies from possible U.S. sanctions. The United States and other Western nations imposed sweeping sanctions on Russia's financial system after Moscow invaded Ukraine in February of 2022. Several banks in China, United Arab Emirates, and Turkey have boosted their sanction compliance requirements, resulting in delays or the rejection of money transfers to Moscow, Reuters reported in March. The delays show how U.S. restrictions have had a strong knock-on effect. Banks cautious of sanctions have started to ask their clients to provide written guarantees that no person or entity from the U.S. Special Designated Nationals list is involved in a deal or is beneficiary of a payment. Our next article, famine risk very high in Gaza, U.S. official says. Israel has taken significant steps in recent weeks on allowing aid into Gaza, the U.S. Special Envoy for Humanitarian Issues said Tuesday. But considerable work remains to be done as the risk of famine in the enclave is high. David Chatterfield declined to say whether Washington was satisfied by Israel's moves week after President Joe Biden demanded action to alleviate the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, saying conditions could be placed on U.S. support for close ally Israel if it did not implement a series of specific concrete and measurable steps. Israel has taken significant steps in these last 2.5 weeks, Satterfield told reporters. There is still considerable work to be done, but progress has been made. The risk of famine throughout war-devastated Gaza, especially in the north, is very high, he said, calling for more to be done to get aid to those in need in that part of the tiny, densely populated Palestinian territory. The United Nations has long complained of obstacles to getting aid in and distributing it throughout Gaza in the 6 months since Israel began an aerial and ground offensive against Gaza's ruling Islamic military group Hamas. Israel's military campaign has reduced much of the territory of 2.3 million people to a wasteland, with an unfolding humanitarian disaster since October, when Hamas ignited war by storming into southern Israel. The head of the UN Palestinian Refugee Agency, Felipe Lazzarani, said on Tuesday that the daily average number of trucks entering Gaza during April was 200, and there had been a peak in Monday of 316. We have always stressed that we were in a man-made situation, and it can only be addressed by political will and decisions. In the last few days, so this is possible, he told reporters. The more we sustain this, the more we will have a positive impact. There was also now a focus on garbage collection, he added, especially in southern Gaza in a bid to avoid disease outbreaks as the warmer weather approaches. UNRWA has been described by top UN officials as the backbone of aid operations in Gaza. But earlier this year, Israel accused 12 UNRWA staff of taking part in the Hamas-led October 7 attacks that triggered the Gaza war. Israel's allegations led 16 countries to pause or suspend funding of $450 million to UNRWA. Larazani said that UNRWA currently has enough funding to pay for operations until June. However, funding by the U.S., UNRWA's biggest donor, at $300 million to $400 million per year, has been suspended by the U.S. Congress until at least March 2025. If it is a lasting suspension, it will have sustainable impact on the agency. If it is a temporary suspension, I do believe we can find a temporary solution with some donors stepping in, Lazzari said. He also said there has been an extraordinary kind of grassroots solidarity with UNRWA, which has raised $100 million from online public donations in the past 6 months. Now we're going to a sports article. USADA calls WADA overhaul amid China swimming scandal. The U.S. Anti-Doping Agency on Tuesday said World Anti-Doping Agency must be overhauled to restore confidence in the global body in advance of the 2024 Paris Olympics, following its handling of a China doping case. USADA wants an independent prosecutor to review the case of 23 Chinese swimmers who tested positive before the Tokyo Olympics began in 2021. But were not punished, as WADA accepted Chinese authorities' explanation that their samples had been contaminated. Athletes and the public desperately need and deserve confidence in the global anti-doping system headed into these Paris Games. It called for governments to appoint an independent prosecutor to review the entire case file of the 23 positive tests and ensure that justice is delivered in these cases. WADA, which held a two-hour media availability on Monday during which its senior officials defended the handling of the case, did not immediately respond when asked by Reuters to comment on the USA's demands. The Chinese swimmers tested positive for trimetazidine months before Tokyo's Olympics began in July of 2021. WADA was notified in June 2021 of the Chinese anti-doping organization's decision to accept that the swimmers were exposed to the substance through contamination from spice containers in the kitchen of a hotel where they were staying. The case file was made available to the WADA Science Department, which determined the contamination scenario was not only plausible, but that there was no concrete element to call it into question. The head of the USADA, Travis Tygart, said on Monday the swimmer should have been provisionally suspended, and his organization kept up the pressure on WADA on Tuesday. The statute of limitations has not run out on these cases, and the pathway for application of rules and dire processes may still exist. Now, going to some business news. Electric car sales to rise. London. Electric car sales will rise significantly in 2024 and increasingly undercut oil demand, according to a forecast Tuesday by International Energy Agency. Adding affordability and charging infrastructure could be the key to future growth. Electric car sales will hit 17 million this year, compared to 14 million in 2023, with more than one in five cars sold globally set to be electric. IEA said predicting 10 million of those sales would be in China. The pace of electric vehicle uptake will mean that oil demand for road transport should peak around 2025, the Paris-based watchdog said in its global electric vehicle outlook. If countries carry through on stated energy and climate policies, some 6 million barrels per day will be shaved off oil demand by 2030 and 11 million by 2035, more than 10% of current total oil demand. Thank you for joining us. Listen Tuesday through Friday at 6 p.m. and Sunday at 1 p.m. for more news from the Arizona Daily Sun. I'm Gary, wishing you a good night.